Hey team, welcome to the Professionally Offensive Podcast. I'm your host, Joseph Cabrera. This is the spot where we provide raw, unfiltered insights from some amazing guests. Stand by, you're about to be offended in all the right ways. All right, team, welcome back to the podcast. I'm here with Kristen Kagetsu, and I'm stoked because she's calling me all the way. We are talking, she's all the way in India right now, West India, and she has got a brilliant company called Sathi Pads, and it's an incredible way that she's making the world a better place by bringing not only sanitary items, but also just other products to folks in need, and really thinking innovatively about how to go about, you know, providing something that's a life necessity. She's doing it with some teammates as well. So Kristen, stoked to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, and really excited to share a little bit more about what we do at Sathi with you and your audience.
Yeah, well, tell me a little bit about where you're at right now. I think that's really fascinating. It's definitely our first time ever having anybody, you know, talking to somebody there. I wish I was in person with you in India right now, but just tell me a little bit about the area there. I think you said it's in Western India and, you know, where the team is, and then talk a little bit about where the company is.
Yeah, for sure. So our company is called Sathi, and we basically make biodegradable and compostable sanitary pads. We also launched menstrual cups recently as well. But basically, we started in order to address lack of access of menstrual products here in India, and wanted to do that in a sustainable way. So we're based in Ahmedabad, Gujarat. So Gujarat is the western part of India, and Ahmedabad is pretty much smack dab in the center of the state, pretty close to the capital of Gujarat, which is called Gandhinagar. Yeah, and Ahmedabad is one of the top 10 cities in terms of population in India, but it might not be as well known outside, just because I think most people are more familiar with like the Mumbai, Bangalore, Delhi's and whatnot. But Gujarat is where Mahatma Gandhi is from, and also the current prime minister is from as well. So maybe those are some notable things about the place where we're
yeah,
based.
Those are, I would say those are pretty notable. So yeah, so when you decided to go and put the team there, how did that come about? And then I want to obviously talk about the company itself, but why was that part of the location so important to the business?
Yeah, so when we were trying to figure out where to set up, I mean, we knew we were going to be in manufacturing, so that was definitely one consideration. There are a couple areas of India that are more known for having good infrastructure and things like that for manufacturing. So we kind of, that narrowed down like which states we wanted to be in. And then city-wise, you know, we wanted to have good access and stuff like that. Also to outside of India, just in case we have other visitors and such. But we also wanted to have like a good environment and community in the city too. So what's nice about Ahmedabad is that there are a lot of actually women NGOs here, and then there's a lot of colleges here too. So we were working quite closely with the colleges around here when we started, especially to work with local students and graduates too. And that's like the backbone of every startup at the beginning is kind of young talent. And so there's like the best business school in India is here, the best design school is here, some really good engineering schools are here too, so it kind of is a hub in a way, similar to how Boston is, I feel like, in the U.S. There's just so many good schools around.
That makes sense. So it's kind of it had a fusion of a lot of different things you guys were looking for probably, and it just kind of came together. Yeah. So yeah, no, I dig that. I guess, tell me a little bit more about, probably need to backtrack a little bit too. It's brilliant. I loved learning about it and talking to you about this stuff before. But tell me, how does a group of MIT students get together, right, and decide to start something that I'm not sure that you would go to an engineering school, the engineering school, you know, and think this would be the leap. So tell me a little bit about the backstory and with your co-founders and how y'all came to found Sathi.
Yeah, so I think, when I tell people like this is kind of what I do, they're like, oh, how does that have to do with engineering, or how does that relate, or like why would you go from MIT to starting a company here and stuff like that. But I think it's interesting because one of the main things, like to me, it's like, well, when I went to MIT, this is what I learned there. Like this kind of stuff is what I learned. Like this is why, you know, it's kind of because of MIT that I'm here. So I almost think the opposite. But basically, there's a couple things that I did during my time at MIT that I feel like are most relevant. So one was a project on waste management and recycling. And that was in Nicaragua. It wasn't in India, but similar kind of situations happen all over the world in the sense of we were in more remote part of, so the eastern coast of Nicaragua, which is more remote in terms of there's like only one road at the time. There was only one road connecting the east and west coast and all these other things. And when there was waste, they had to actually like bring it either over that road or through plane to Managua. And then they would actually not even process it there. They would send it to Costa Rica. So I was like, oh, this is a whole, you know, I mean, this is very involved. And just to get rid of waste, which easily comes into the country, right? Because everyone wants to sell more products. So, how do we kind of think through collection of this waste and then processing to, can we do it locally, et cetera? So that kind of planted a seed of like, okay, well, you know, this is very complicated, very difficult to handle. Obviously, otherwise, somebody would have figured that out already. And not a lot of people find like waste very exciting to deal with. And so that's one project which was kind of planting a seed of, okay, how do we handle this? And the other thing was I had a chance to work on a project in India, which was around an NGO that actually works on dyeing, natural dyeing of textiles. And so they had a lot of pigments left over from that process, and they really wanted to work on how do we use those pigments in some other kind of product for kids. They had said, oh, we want to make crayons. And so I kind of helped them develop a recipe for crayons, which was using local materials. And so in a way, it kind of ended up being almost these natural dye, locally sourced, you know, almost like eco-friendly product in a way. And between those two things, I was like, okay, these are kind of, I like this kind of work. I like these kinds of the communities we're working with, like the impact that it's having. And those were some of the inklings of how I think personally I got interested in all of this kind of stuff.
It sounds like you were following much more your intuition than some like very objective plan to where you got to.
Yeah, it definitely was, I think, a bit more of looking for experiences and impactful. So like the one main thread to me at the time as a student was just, I want to work on as many impactful projects as possible. So I had also done like a kind of leadership and technology training program for students in China too. And I had done other things like, you know, basically all the projects that I had done were something along the lines of impact related, whether the format was a little different, like waste management and recycling, I was doing more of a tech focused thing. The other one, it was a little more like focused on leadership and education and stuff. Even post-graduation, I did like this leadership, I volunteered for a leadership organization, national leadership organization. So it's always been about the impact. That's a common thread. And I think most of them have also been related somewhat to the environment. To some degree, or sustainability, even though at the time I may not have been thinking of it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just maybe a leaning that I've found over the years. But I think having the chance to experience those things or even try them out for a little while or a couple months, that sort of thing, it really made me think, you know, this is the kind of work that I want to do. But I didn't, it wasn't like when I graduated, I immediately jumped into Saathi either. Like I didn't, like all of those things didn't come to me at once. It was like over years, I tried these different things and it's like, okay, this is, I was developing the idea kind of, oh, this is what I like, kind of thing. So I had signed up for a job in Massachusetts. And it was at that point where I, you know, this is at one of the big tech companies. I was you know, doing this hardware job or whatnot. And I was like, this is not for me. I don't like pretty much any part of it, really. Like, I don't see what impact I'm having on people. Like, yes, you could say, oh, well, if you're designing certain kind of technology, it's, people are using it, it's like, okay, but, you know, people, there's a lot more basic needs that people have too. And yeah, so then I kind of made a list of, after reflecting on all these experiences, it's so much easier now to say, oh, it kind of makes sense. But
all the dots connected perfectly, but they never do look forward. Yeah.
But yeah, but at the time I had to really think hard, like, okay, these are the things that I really want. If I'm going to switch, I don't want to be in this kind of position again. So what is it that I'm really looking for? And that's where things started to come together. And I was like, oh, okay. So I want to be in India. You know, I want to do things that impact people, particularly focus on women, if at all possible, et cetera. And so working through that helped to kind of refine this, I think, the goals that we have as well.
Yeah, no, that's, so as you were putting all those pieces together, was your initial team, was it just you at first saying, okay, let me go try this new thing out and let's see if it works? Or did you have some teammates that kept you accountable?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. I had teammates. I guess I was like Prasati for sure. So there was a kind of concept out there of like thinking about this from the perspective of distributed manufacturing. And that was kind of the original, you could say, concept. But that kind of all went out the window once I was in India. And I met Tarun here in India, actually. So all I had at the time when I met him was like some ideas on paper and something like that and a few contacts and stuff, but just generally not very much in real life, you know, kind of ideas and things like that. And so when Tarun and I kind of like started working on everything, we had to develop the whole model, and we actually shifted from distributed manufacturing to the model we have today, which is where we manufacture the product, and we've now redesigned the product. And part of that was in our understanding of like how things were being done at the time. Like other people were trying to make low cost, but they were also low quality products, and distribute those to as many women as possible and things like that. But that wasn't necessarily satisfactory to us because we didn't want to send low quality products out to people because they don't function as well, and then they're not used properly, and then that defeats the whole purpose of access in the first place. And there were other models as well, and I think for us, we really wanted to see what different, like what difference can we make, or what contribution can we have to this ecosystem. And that's where we thought, well, if we're bringing products to the places which lack access, the majority of those will be in rural areas. And in rural areas, you don't have access to waste infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have access to waste infrastructure, then we're going to bring all these single-use products into that environment, and then it's going to create a waste problem. So it's like thinking a little bit beyond kind of the next step of the product itself and how it's being used and what's going to happen later, that we're like, okay, well, there must be a better way. We should try and see, like, can we make this product completely biodegradable and compostable? So it took us a year and a half to kind of switch over our business model, find, like, make the new prototypes, and then we had to set up our own manufacturing unit. And so all these things just took time. It wasn't overnight, but yeah, I think that's kind of the journey.
I find it fascinating, you know, in a world where it's become easy or almost common practice to outsource manufacturing or to, you know, have, you know, someone else basically doing the heavy lifting on your product while maybe the company focuses on marketing and product development and those kind of things. I really dig the fact that y'all decided to bring it in-house. I mean, you definitely decided to put on a heavier backpack to go make that work, but any regrets like for doing that? Is that, you know, or was that the best decision you think you could have made?
I think we debated this a lot. I mean, yeah. You know, other people also said to us, you know, this is stupid. You guys don't know anything. You know, this is going to be a big fail and all that stuff. And, you know, I think there's reasons why we chose to do it. And we still, I mean, we still can say, okay, those reasons are still valid today. I would say it definitely was a tougher journey. I wouldn't say I regret it. I do think it's been harder and taken a bit longer than we were hoping. Yeah. So I think to scale, I think that's the main thing, you know, that's the holy grail of all startups is to scale. And I think that has not been simple, I would say. But personally, I don't regret it. I think we've learned quite a lot, and it's been pretty cool to kind of see how we can connect with people like all over the world with the kind of work we're doing. So the impact we've gotten to make is awesome. Like the stories people tell us about whatever way that they're interacting with us and how that's making some difference. I think that makes it all worth it. So definitely don't regret it. But it is hard. Yeah.
It is hard. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like too, there's probably a balance there between, like, you're right. You think about scalability. It's a very common business thing to be thinking about, of course. But I got to imagine the way y'all are doing it now, there is probably a lot more, would you say there's a lot more kind of culture being built because you get to have your hands on everything from end to end to include, you know, hiring and empowering teammates that work directly for the team?
Yeah, I think there's that. I think, what's interesting also is like the scope of our, you know, so we were talking about vision and all of that, and I think the scope of what we want to achieve or the change that we want to make, we have more control over that when we're not just in on the marketing side. Mm-hmm. And we saw that one of the options at the beginning, we saw from the beginning that one of the options is to be in marketing, but that's not really our, we want to make the impact, right? That was our main goal in the whole first place, is to make the impact. And as a marketer, you're funding the impact, you could say, but you may or may not be making it. So we wanted to have that hands-on experience. Like, you know, we've gone to the village and we've, like, you know, been there when we're like, while doing the surveys, obviously there's a someone who's local from the community working on the surveys and everything. So we're just kind of observers in that case, but we've been there in that position. Whereas like if we're in marketing, we might've gone for like a, you know, photo op or something. But in this case, we really get to have hands-on experience with our end beneficiaries in villages, even in urban slum areas and things like that, that we're able to have that interaction, which I think we wouldn't necessarily have if we weren't integrated fully into the system. So.
Yeah, no doubt that it's tougher and there's probably a lot more moving parts that way. But at the same time, I can imagine that, you know, y'all being impact first is exactly what you wanted out of it. Talk to me more about just the main problem you guys set out to solve at the beginning. I know you've talked about it, and, you know, but just specifically, what is the main problem y'all started to, you know, set out to solve? And then how's that evolved where you're at today?
Yeah, so the main problem we were looking to address was lack of access to menstrual products in India. And the part that we kind of added on as we understood more about the situation was how to do this in a sustainable way. And that's created this thing where we're trying to basically be a responsible and sustainable manufacturer, essentially. And that's part of kind of our big vision. But I think in terms of lack of access, so in India at the time, it was around like 18% of women had access to sanitary pads. Now it's more like, 36%. So that's over the course of time. It's not obviously just our doing. Of course, there are many other companies, you know, contributing to this. But even to be part of that movement is pretty amazing. And I think one of the things is looking at, you know, that number is moving. So there, you know, there's already a shift, and there's just so much more, like so many more women and girls to reach, that we just, like, you know, people talk about competition and all that, but there's almost like, you could say there's no, like, in some ways there's no competition because you have, there's like 70%, or you can say 64% of the market, it's still there, right? Specific, like yeah. It's not saturated yet. I mean, actually, many markets aren't saturated, even though people say they are, but I just feel like there's just so much more need, not just in India, but across the world, that it's really something where we see this as two parts. One, you can say, let's just talk about the product. Okay, having access to the product is one thing. Needing to know how do you use it. Okay, so health education is another thing. So one of the reasons why I think we've come into this as a systemic change type of organization and not just the, oh, we're going to have products solve the problem, is actually products don't solve any problems. They only are a tool in a way of like one tool. So when we look at this, okay, what's actually there? Well, it's not just access, but awareness and understanding. And if you don't have any health education background, then, or if you even dropped out of school at, you know, sixth grade or something like this, then where are you going to get that understanding? What is menstruation? Why do we have it? You know, you'll have all these questions in your mind. I mean, we take for granted that we even have basic health education in the US, and there's some gaps there too, but we take that for granted even, like, at least you know what a period is. And then beyond that, if there's other gaps, I mean, this is one of the things that we also try to do, like, have workshops and talk about this. And then, like, thinking about it from the perspective of, okay, what does it mean when you don't have your pads? Well, maybe you'll run out to the store and get it or that sort of thing, but there's taboos to face. You know, many of the shop owners are men, then women don't feel as comfortable because it's kind of a hush-hush thing. Like, even the shop owner makes it kind of a little awkward for you to ask about, and there's a lot of pointing and gesturing and paper bags and such, and you don't want to kind of mention it in public, kind of thing.
Easy to, like, just walk down the aisle, grab it, and feel okay to go to the register. That's a whole process.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then there's no self-checkout too. Like, if you're, so that's in a grocery store, but if we're talking like regular shops where, like, in a village, you wouldn't have a grocery store. You would have like the local shop. And so if you go to a local shop, it's just a counter and then a guy standing behind it, usually a guy is standing behind the counter and selling the things and stuff. And so then you have that interaction as well. Or let's say you're in the grocery store. So like at home or in New York or whatever, any city in the US, you have CVS, Walgreens, Wayneed, whatever. And most of those have self-checkout. So even if you didn't want to like interact with anyone, you could actually just check it out yourself. But that's not common in India to have self-checkout. So you do have to interact with even like the swipe, the cashier who's swiping all your stuff. And anyway, all those things can be awkward, especially given the general taboo, I think, around these products. And then the second thing is, if you look at, there are plenty of articles and reports and things online, but if you look up, like, a lot of women are saying, oh, well, you should use cloth pads, you should use menstrual cups. These are more eco-friendly and women should use those in rural areas, and then you won't have to deal with the waste either. So cloth, one of the things about that is cloth is, you know, there's some reports saying, oh, it's not safe to use. It is safe to use, but if you use it and you disinfect it properly. So the best way to disinfect it would be to have it dry, either in, like, if you have a dryer, or to dry it out in the sun. And so if you dry it out in the sun, you face the same thing. Well, then everyone in the community will know that you're on your period, and that's a bit of a challenge. And so that's one of the reasons people don't dry it outside. They'll dry it inside, but then it doesn't get that UV exposure, and then it can grow fungus and other things, and then you get infections. So that's kind of the longer explanation of, like, why cloth may or may not be the best option, depending on the comfort of the person using it and that sort of thing. With cups, there's two potential challenges. Not to say it's not going to work anywhere, but depending either on the community's beliefs or understanding with, like, acceptance of inserting an item, like, if you don't really feel like that's, if you as the user don't feel it's comfortable for you, that's one thing. If the community doesn't really accept it. That's another thing. And then on top of that, some communities don't have access to a lot of water, drinking water, et cetera. Clean water, I could say. So if you don't have clean water, you're not going to wash either your cups or your pads, cloth pads, and therefore disposable might be best in that community. And one of the things that's interesting, like when you read articles, you're always reading about village in such and such, whatever country, but not every village is the same, right? Some villages have, like, we went to three, and this is just three types, but three kind of villages that in Uttar Pradesh, which were like, you know, one was kind of near the main road, one was a little bit farther away, and one was very, very remote. And so, like, these are all different situations. Every village will need a different solution.
No, it's incredible. Like, so, I mean, you're this is the stuff that I love bringing up in entrepreneurship. Like, you got the initial problem set that you're trying to solve for, but the second and tertiary things are often the things that we don't always anticipate, right? Like you just mentioned, it's the, not only the creation of the product and a good product and solving a problem and access, but then it's the logistics of even getting the product. You could have something brilliant and you can't get it in a way. Why? Because of a third issue, which is culturally, it's not acceptable to even go get the product in a traditional way that we take for granted in the US and so, or in the Western world. And so it's fascinating how, like, as an operator, you have to not just think about how do I build a really great product that's going to be, you know, good and sanitary and high quality and at the same time takes care of the planet, but then also how do I get people to get to it? And so that's a really fascinating thing to think through. So when you're thinking about access, what are some of the thoughts that go through your brain about how you get them to, you know, to ladies that need this, so that they're also, I imagine, trying to shift a culture norm is a bigger issue at the immediate, you know, immediately. Is there an access kind of way that you've thought about how to short circuit this, you know, the situation?
Yeah. So one of the things is there's plenty of organizations already working locally with many groups of women, communities, villages, etc. And we're not trying to reinvent that wheel at all. And you know, there's a reason why there are local NGOs in every locality or district or even state or whatsoever. It's not like there's one national one that covers every single area. And that's because of the relationships. This is a very personal product and those relationships matter. And it's also a health product. And so, you know, we focus, there's still so many people to partner with, you know, in terms of working directly with the groups of women that, and girls that need it. So we partner with NGOs locally and make sure that we're able to reach beneficiaries directly, as opposed to being like, oh, let's sell to a local shop. I mean, by the time the product gets to the local shop, like there's so many margins and stuff. Like if you go through retail and whatsoever, that it's like almost pointless to kind of bother going through those traditional methods. It's best to really, like, that's kind of for the big multinationals to play around with margins and, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Like, we're here trying to provide access. And so because of that, we're going directly to NGOs and the communities, and working in that way, we're able to reach so many more women all at once. Because they already have the network, they already have, like, you know, community gatherings and things like that where we can do the workshops. So it's a lot more streamlined.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. So talk to me about the way the product is created. So is I feel very unique, and I don't know if it's something that's been new to the world or not, but as I've learned more about what y'all are doing and how you create it, it blew my mind. So if you could tell me about how is the product created? Seems like the most sustainable way I've ever heard.
Thanks. So it's pretty unique, at least so far as we know, also based on all of our research that we've done. Basically, we use banana fiber and bamboo fiber. So both are natural fibers, but they're generally considered waste, agri-waste. So for example, with banana fiber, it's the stem of the tree, and every harvest, the tree has to be cut down in order to make room for a new tree. And that's 9 or 12 months. It's every year. So if those are cut down anyway, and a lot of people just throw it on the side of the road, then it's a kind of resource that we can use to make our product. And you kind of,
that's like the trunk part, Kristen. Is that like the trunk part that just gets chopped off and thrown away? Okay, got it.
Yeah. And so because of that, it's like, well, why not use somebody else's waste? And at the same time, it's something where, you know, farmers are definitely one of the groups that's also in most need, I think, in India because of all the climate-related challenges as well. So if we can provide additional income by buying their waste, or like waste meaning not on purpose, but just they don't need it, then it's something that, we can kind of try to contribute in that way as well. So that's one of our metrics of success, is to measure how much additional income we can provide for farmers based on using their.
That's a very interesting KPI. That's not something that you would normally see in an investor or a board deck, or it's, let me tell you about how much money we're making other people. That's not usually a thing that you would hear. So I think that's really neat to see that community way of approaching your business.
Yeah. People do ask us about metrics, and we have like 5 metrics which are most important to us, but they're all related to impact, which I mean, maybe says something about how we run, which is a little different. But I think recently somebody was like, oh, I'm so impressed that you actually measure your impact. So it's like, oh, but we have to. I mean, like, why else would we be doing all this work if we weren't measuring our impact? Because that's partly like the whole point kind of why we exist. But anyway, I think it's really interesting because we're kind of working to address multiple of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, but those were created, I think, 2015, announced at least formally with all the goals listed and everything. And that's when we started. So at the time, we didn't know about the UN Sustainability Goals because we were like, oh, yeah, we're just doing our thing kind of thing. And then later we found out that then we're like, wait, we can like totally align our, you know, messaging to be very clear as to how we're addressing these things. And so that was kind of nice because it gave everyone more of a level playing field as to, oh, what is it that you do exactly? And it's like, oh, you know about the UN SDGs? Yes. Okay, great. Then we can start from there. Makes more sense. So.
Has it helped having that backing or having that at least backdrop of the UN initiatives there? Has that been helpful or has it just been kind of a, you know, somewhat helpful?
I think it's been helpful for certain groups of people because they're quite familiar with them already. And so it just gives us that basis of, oh, you know, when we're talking about impact, how do you really measure it? And what do you really measure against? Or like, how can you explain this to me in a way that I understand? So that's helped us communicate it. Because at first we would explain our business model and people were like, I just, you know, it sounds like a lot of things are going on. And it's true, but, you know, we are trying to create this like new system of sustainable manufacturing. And I think that's kind of where people get confused. They're like, don't you sell pads? It's like, yes. And, you know, that's one of our things that we're doing, but selling pads is only one part of the solution to the problem, right? Like we're still trying to address this problem of access and that includes education, that includes all these other things. And if you don't have a pad, what does that mean for the women and girls and all that? So I think it's like trying to take a more holistic approach to the solution. That's our goal.
Okay, so talk to me about, as you're talking about all the things that, you know, that drive your business, the KPIs, the things, what sparked in my brain right now is the impact part. I'll tell you that like a lot of folks in this world, I think we're naturally geared to want to make an impact. But I'm curious, like where did that come from? Was that something when you were younger that you kind of looked at the world differently? Or was this lots of opportunities in business that kind of shaped it differently for you? Like what drives you so impact driven versus maybe traditional business KPIs?
I think that comes from both me and Darren. he's very impact driven too, which is probably why we get along and like want to run Sati together. And like for him, I think he's particularly interested in how he can impact women and girls because in his he's had personal experiences in his family also, seeing kind of some of these minds change and behavior change and all of that. And I'll kind of let him speak to that story as it's more personal to him. But I think the other thing is, like for me, maybe, I don't know. I think one of the things is just like, if I am going to choose what I want to spend my time and my career, I guess, in, I'm like, yes, I want to like obviously have enough money to live, like, you know, live in an apartment or something like that, or, you know, travel or something like this. But I think I don't need to have like excess, I suppose. And so if I'm going to also think about how do I want to use my time, I want to leave some good, I don't know. I want to do something that's going to be good for like other people too, because I think maybe it's, I don't know if it's like where exactly it came from, but I think just seeing, you know, the disparities in the world, it's kind of shocking and really unfortunate that, you know, so many have so much and the like, or so few have so much and so many are lacking like basic necessities, like clean water, a place to live, you know, things like that. So
yeah, no, I can.
I'm not sure if I can pinpoint that, but yeah.
No, it's perfect. I mean, I find it motivating because I do think that a lot of folks can get into business because of the business part of it, which is, or the financial part of it, I should say, which isn't wrong. To your point, you need those things to sustain your life, and it's a way to keep score. But at the same time, it's also really refreshing to hear someone talk through more about how even the way they run their business, even metrically, is much more about impact than it is something else. I've actually always been fascinated with businesses. You know, when you think about nonprofits or whatever, if they could run more like a business, and if businesses could run a little sometimes more like a nonprofit, if there was a more synergistic way of getting the two of those things together, I think you'd have an unstoppable machine, right? Because culturally, you'd
right.
be able to instill some things even on the team there that are just hard to replicate unless you have a mission that's driving you forward. What keeps y'all going with that? I mean, what is the thing that y'all talk about, Sati, a lot? I'm sure that you have endless ideas, but what is the thing that continues to keep y'all going to the next ridgeline and the next ridgeline?
Yeah. Before I answer that, I wanted to mention one thing that you just said about NGOs and businesses. I think one of the things is like, yeah, NGOs, you know, they want to do good, but then they're always tied to trying to get donations and things like that, and we could definitely have started an NGO, and that would make it really easy for people to contribute and that sort of thing. But then at the same time, we thought, well, we want to make something that is self-sustaining and can run on its own, which is why we kind of have this, you know, it's not exactly a traditional hybrid model, but definitely hybrid in the way that we talk to people. And I think that's why some people confuse us for an NGO, actually, because they're like, oh, you know, just because you're mission driven, you must be an NGO. So that's one thing. But in terms of what keeps us going, I think it's a long-term vision that we have, like what we're trying to build and the change that we're trying to make. So I think we want to, we do want to impact, you know, the problems that we've kind of addressed as well. And we want to create this kind of systemic change because I think that will have a longer term success. Like that will last longer and last beyond us, hopefully, and you know, try to make that kind of impact. And I think knowing that big picture is in the future is something that helps us kind of be like, okay, you know, we have some challenges today or frustrating situations, but it's all ultimately going to be helping us achieve the bigger picture goal. And it's sometimes something where, you know, you have to remind yourself of that, like depending on the situation, right? Like some things can just be so frustrating. It's like, okay, I just need, you know, some time off, or I need to do something fun, or like, you know, watch some videos or a movie, or I don't know, do something. Yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, to get back into the game, or into, I mean, it's not a game, but to get back to work and kind of have that motivation, it's thinking about the bigger picture.
Yeah, no, it's keeping your eyes on. I think this is where it creates the sustainability within the company to continue moving forward. I think I've always found that it sounds like, you know, it's a combination between having a good mission, so having time to reset and refocus. And then it sounds like in your case, you have a really great partner that can kind of help you stay accountable to each other. So I'm sure there are days you're up and he's down and he's up and you're down and you're just able to kind of keep pulling. Cause otherwise, I mean, it can be ruthless trying to get a business moving forward to the right, especially with what y'all are doing. I mean, it's, you know, it's a new thing in a tough environment. So yeah, all those things coming together.
Yeah. And I think like in the early days, there were kind of a lot more people that were like, oh, you should do it like this, or you should do it like that, or I don't understand what it is you're trying to do, or, you know, I don't understand the product, or something would always come up. And we'd always have to be like, okay, but we know based on our research and our understanding of what we, you know, the market or our product or whatever it was, technology, something, that we're like, okay, we're very sure that data backs up what we say and that it is possible and we're going to give it our best shot. And so, yeah, but I think having a co-founder is amazing. Obviously having people who believe in what we do. We've had some great mentors too, and support systems. So we've been part of a number of different, I don't know, like entrepreneur groups, I guess you can say, or like, that sort of thing. And those have really helped kind of boost our confidence in that what we're doing is along the right lines, I guess, if that sort of thing.
When you look back into when Scythe kicked off, what do you think about one or two things that you believe brought you to where you're at today? You know, was there something there that you said, I think the reason we're still alive, because it's impressive, right? Like most businesses, I think what's the metric, don't go past 3 years. But like when you think about where you're at today, was there something in there that you say, that's the reason why I think we're still here?
I think there's a lot of reasons maybe that we're still here. I think, you know, certain of these, you know, awards or groups that supported us came at a crucial time, you know. Just when we thought, oh man, this is it. You know, if we don't get X, Y, and Z, I think startups go through this all the time. But if we don't get this, we're going to be done for. And we'd always find a way to kind of, whether that thing happened or not, you know, it depended on the year, but sometimes it did happen, sometimes it didn't. And so we'd always have to find a way to make do. And there were some stressful times, like, you know, where we weren't sure how we could pay the staff and like all the normal, you know, startup things that happen. And I think we had to have a way to problem solve and think through how do we get around this. Two, of course, we leaned on our support network and our mentors to say like, hey, you know, this is, how do we kind of plan for, like, what is plan B or what does it look like? Or how do we go about this even, you know, sometimes we were just so unsure as to what plan B would look like. And some of them would just be like, okay, let's just take this, you know, from scratch and like start to build this up and see what options you have, things like that. And so I think there were quite a lot of different moments that led to us still being around. COVID was not fun for anyone, but I mean, for running this kind of business also, like there were a lot of logistics. We have a manufacturing unit. You don't want people in there. Everyone else who had manufacturing units had to do the same kind of like restrictions and everything. And as a small company, all those changes are even bigger, or they seem bigger. And so like all of those things, I think, tested our creativity or adaptability, I guess. And I think one of the things that's been constant is our goal has been constant. Our mission and vision are constant. And so you could say those are the things that have stuck around since the beginning. And I think that's probably in a way like why we still are able to gather others to be part of this community or other supporters and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, and it as you talk about it too, and this whole time, and as we've talked before, you don't strike me as somebody who's, you both don't strike me as folks who are gonna, you know, we're looking for that, let's go climb this thing, hockey stick growth, and then exit. You know, you've talked about legacy businesses and having things that stand, you know, for a while. Can you talk to me about just kind of how you think about those things? Because of course, I'm in that boat too. I really enjoy the idea of having businesses that can be household names for the right reasons and be around for a while. So just kind of what are your thoughts on that with Sathi? Is that how you're thinking about it?
Yeah, I think for sure. We want to have a long lasting impact. And that's why we're looking at how we can really make some kind of like build out, not just the fact that we have a product, but we've done workshops as well. We're looking at the end use of the product, that sort of thing. So we're seeing all of these aspects. And I think one of the things is, you know, how we can kind of maintain that for the long term. In terms of our legacy and that sort of thing, I think one of the things we actually are really trying hard to build is this model for sustainable manufacturing. And so it might sound a little strange, like how does that relate? But basically we're making sustainable product for menstrual hygiene, and we have ideas on how to make other products also. And I think if we can kind of create this model where we're working on like other products in the hygiene industry or an absorbent industry, and say, okay, look, you can have a responsible manufacturing business, you can have a sustainable manufacturing business, and you can have all of these, you can grow and you can have all these impacts, then others in other industries would be creating things like business in a new way kind of thing. And
so you're thinking about even bigger than just like, it's bigger than just building the products you're building right now. It's how do we create a framework and a model that helps other people do their business in a better way too?
That's our big idea, I suppose. I mean,
it's awesome.
I'm sure someone's thought about it before, but that's what we want to do. I mean, we want to implement that. And I think, and we know that's not going to happen tomorrow or whatever, but I think that's something, that's what we want our legacy to be. And I think in terms of one of the things that helped with that, like, so at first we were like, yeah, this is what we want to do. But it's hard to talk with people about that when most people are thinking hockey stick, and that's including investors too. Mm-hmm. So if investors are the ones that give you the money, then if they all pretty much, that's the majority thought process, then it's going to be very hard to find people to invest in our business model because that's what they want too. And I understand that's how everyone's like, oh, but that's how they work. That's how they're incentivized. And I'm like, okay, but clearly that's a broken system. If we, you know, if we're just incentivizing even the investors, you know, they have LPs and they have to report to them. And if that's how we're incentivizing all kinds of business, then maybe that's not the way we should be incentivizing, because what kind of business are you creating then if you're only having this business sell to another business and that's their main goal in life? Like, that model might not be for everyone or whatever. So I heard about this 100-year company kind of concept from some companies in Japan. And I think that's really, I mean, there are other companies around the world too, but there's more of the like 100-year-old companies in Japan. And one of the companies that we met through this program run by Earth Company is a company that's actually 500 years old.
Really?
So if you can, yeah, if you can just imagine like 500 years old, I mean, like the United States, you know, it's not even like, that's not even there yet. So it's just, it's really interesting to think like, okay, they've weathered many storms, wars, disasters of all kinds. And so like, it really puts your everyday problems in perspective. And like, you just think, okay, so maybe it's like slow and steady kind of growth or that sort of thing, but still it's pretty cool. Like you can have that, you don't have to like try to beat everyone right away, be the top of the pack and then like, that's it. And maybe sell out or make billions of dollars. And then, I don't know, buy an island or something, but you could also have this kind of like, it's very stereotypical, but you could have this kind of like long lasting company that's contributing to society or whatever, like for many, many years or centuries in this case. I mean, that's an extreme example, of course, but it was just really cool to hear a different perspective of like, you know, I don't think like, from what I understood, it's not like they're like, oh, you know, we're like the richest family in Japan, but they have this legacy and they're able to kind of like adapt to all the different needs.
Was there a common thread that they also had, these 100-plus-year-old companies there, Kristen? Was there a common thread that you noticed? Was it like a certain industry or just culture was certain?
No, it's not. I don't think it was the industry. It's more like looking at legacy, actually. Like, what is it that you want to leave for the next generation? And, you know, decisions you make today will impact the next generation. And in that case, like, you're still looking at the company, right? But I think it matters, like, what people... Like if you're in it for the short game, like 5 years, yeah, you know, a couple bad reputation may or may not impact you, right? Things like that. So,
no, it's a mindset that you got to be able to get behind. I think it's coming back. I don't want to say maybe didn't leave, but maybe got overwhelmed. But I do think that it's coming back. I think folks do want to create something meaningful. I think the new generations really want to see legacy come back. So it makes me kind of, I'm stoked to hear that's what y'all are shooting for. Well, look, I know we got a few minutes here left, so I want to kind of give you, what are y'all working on? I want to give y'all for a little bit, and what are the things right now as a company y'all are looking for or looking forward to, and what are y'all's kind of immediate needs, and how can kind of people keep following you and what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so what we're currently working on is we're actually working on a new kind of a concept called plastic avoidance credits. So some people may be more familiar with carbon credits and how that works. Plastic credits are a bit newer, so they're still in the kind of voluntary market, but there's two types of plastic credits right now. One is around collection of plastic waste, and the other is around recycling of plastic waste. And what we're proposing is that there should be a plastic avoidance credit, because the whole point of it is that if you're going to be paying money to for a plastic credit, then if you're paying money to avoid plastic being put out there in the world, then that's the most efficient way to kind of stop or prevent you having to pay later for collection or recycling. And we're not naive. We know that there's lots of use cases for recyclable plastics. We're not advocating that every single plastic on earth has to be eliminated, but we are saying trying to reduce the amount of plastics. Like, everyone who's making things with plastic might want to think twice about, is this really necessary? Can I do something different, etc.? And also looking at how we can be kind of on that forefront of supplying a credit which big companies want. So you know, kind of sustainability heads or that sort of thing, or like interested to kind of work with us, that's something we can provide. We're looking at kind of more partnerships and things like that. Those are kind of things that we're trying to create right now. So partnerships with companies and CSR opportunities to distribute pads to more women, because there's way more need than we can serve even with direct one-for-one sales.
Yeah.
And then where to find us? We're on pretty much all the traditional social media. So Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And it's all at Sathi Pads. So I think we post our major announcements and things like that on there. But a good way to find us and follow along.
Any teammates or anybody you're looking for, like as you guys are growing, is there anybody that, you know, maybe be listening to this and saying, man, I really like what Sathi's doing over there, and maybe I got to figure out how to join the team or join the fight?
Yeah, that'd be awesome. So far, we are mainly hiring in India, in our office in Ahmedabad, but we have had volunteers work with us from abroad too, just because of, you know, time zones and everything. It generally works better, like in the evenings or whatnot. So we've had volunteers and we've had interns from all over the world as well. So definitely looking for support there. And there's pretty much any interest you have, we'd probably be able to find something that kind of fits both your interests and our needs, except for maybe machine learning or AI or apps. I think those are the only three things we don't have, but most other things I think are fair game in a way.
That's great. Well, then I'm sure if anybody's listening right now, I'm sure someone is motivated to kind of join what you guys are doing. So, well, Kristen, thank you so much for this time. It's been incredible learning about what y'all are doing, not only what y'all are doing, but why you're doing it. I think that's something that we kind of take for granted as to why business and business operators are doing what they're doing. It's not just financial. You're actually, you know, trying to create an impact. I'd love to see what, imagine a board deck for y'all. It looks very different than probably a traditional company, and I dig it. So thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to kind of keeping track of y'all and seeing what's going on here in the future.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks so much. This is great.
Well, thank you all for listening. This is the Professionally Offensive Podcast. You can catch us on all platforms. JC out.